welcome to The Beauty Files. I'm Juanita. I'm so glad you can join us today. Happy Friday. We have a really good show for you today. You know, spring is in the air, and a lot of us are thinking about, renewing ourselves, our image, our well-being. So today's show, we have three guests. The last guest is a fun guest that has nothing to do with image unless, you know, eating pizza, which I love. she's going to teach us the art of making pizza on our own instead of always ordering it out or having it delivered. So can't wait to talk with Ruth Gressner. Also, we're going to be talking to David McGrady. He's a hypnotherapist, and he also is a life coach, and he's going to give us some information about hypnosis. Can you be hypnotized? I don't know. I don't think I can. I keep saying that I can't, and I'm gonna ask Dave if I can actually get hypnotized. But first, we're joined by William Cain. He is a best-selling author and a formal trial attorney and founder of Manhattan Makeovers. What he does is that he helps shape the looks of hundreds of celebrities, presidential candidates, A-list actors, Academy Award this Sunday, doctors, lawyers, bankers, and professionals. And he is going to give us some information on what he can do for you as far as being an image consultant. Welcome, William, to The Beauty Files.
Thank you very much, Juanita. It's a pleasure.
What is your background? I mean, how can you call yourself an image consultant? What do you, what do you have to do to become an image consultant?
I began as an attorney, and then I also worked as a lecturer in English, and I taught over 6,000 students, many of whom had no idea of what is the appropriate way to dress. And when they started going for interviews, some of them asked me for help, and I did help many of them. And then I began to work in theater. And as a theatrical producer, I worked with the people in the wardrobe department, of course, and hairdressers and makeup artists. And I got to see how transformations of actors could affect the way they were received on stage. Well, I put all of this together in 2007, and I decided to help professional people. And that's what we do now. We basically bring in from all over the country attorneys, bankers, PhDs, doctors, and we help these professional people, and we help them with their attire, their hair, their footwear, and all of that image type of material. And we base it on the work of John T. Malloy and also continuing research that we've done, and we show what is actually effective for these professionals. And by effective, I mean what actually works to make them more successful rather than less successful with their colleagues and people they interact with in the workplace.
Wow. So can, that whole expression, you are what you look like or however it goes, can a person, the way they dress, can that determine, like, if they can make more money, they can have a better presence, if they can be received better?
Oh, it certainly can, and there is research to back that assertion up. We have found that the salespeople, for example, who it's very easy to tabulate how much money they make, when we put them in the correct attire or the more effective attire, they will outperform those who are wearing ineffective attire. For example, putting a man in a jacket and a tie or putting a woman in a skirt suit and using the right colors, for example, for sales, it would be navy blue and beige, you will find that those salespeople and those salesmen and women will outperform their colleagues. It's very, very clear that dressing a certain way will help you to earn more, especially in sales, but in many other professions and other industries as well.
Wow. So what about shoes? You know, because you see a lot of women now and men. I mean, I'm a shoe person as far as when I see a guy that I work with and, he comes in and he has crazy-looking shoes or bad-looking shoes. It's kind of a turnoff because I'm thinking, you have this great suit on, but you have these crummy shoes.
You know, that's funny because our political consultant who's worked with people who are running for high national office and state office told me a story. He was in a taxi cab with one of his clients, and the client was in the front seat with his wife. And my associate was in the back seat, and the wife turned around and she said to him in a low voice, "He will not like the shoes you are wearing." And she handed him $300 and she said, "Get yourself a new pair of shoes." And she told him the only two types of shoes that would be effective, and they are, for men, a cap-toe shoe, which has a line at the front of the toe and is a very plain dress shoe, and the other was a wingtip, which has a pattern of indentations or holes in the shoe, which is also a very dressy shoe. And those are the only two shoes, and they should be black, that a man who is in a white-collar job should wear. As for women, well, the most effective thing is a pump. And this is one piece of advice that has not changed in 25 years. A closed toe, closed heel pump with a heel no more than 2.5 inches. For a professional woman, it is the only shoe that is effective.
I'm glad you said 2.5 inch, because now I'm seeing 5, 6. You know, I'm not understanding that look, because it doesn't look to me as professional. I mean, I like the fact that you said 2-inch heel, but we are seeing a lot of the platformed 6-inch, 5-inch heels in the workplace now, in bankers' offices and, you know, federal government. I don't get that heel.
You're right to have that reaction. I mean, that's a gut reaction, which is in tune with research, and those women who are wearing those particular high heels, they will, generally speaking, they will be passed over for promotion, and they will not do as well as their colleagues who are wearing the more conservative look.
Really?
Oh,
wow.
Absolutely. I mean, the research on professional women being given a promotion and also moving up the hierarchy, it's very clear. And that's research that you will not find in a fashion magazine or on television.
So you say here, I'm reading some of your stuff, but you say, why is it a mistake? And I want to know that. Why shouldn't women wear pants to work? What's the problem with that? Because you know Hillary Clinton wears pants pantsuits all the time.
I will explain why I believe Hillary Clinton's decision will actually impair her ability to get the votes she wants. And the reason is that our research reveals that pants turn on 53% of men, and they antagonize or threaten 6% of blue-collar workers, which means that you are going to have the opposite effect that you want on your colleagues and on people that you're interacting with. Because at work, you don't want to turn people on, and it is, you will be more successful if you are wearing a skirt suit if you're a woman. However, there are some exceptions. There are some cases where there can be exceptions to this. For example, if a woman is severely overweight, mm-hmm. then in those cases, wearing a pantsuit could be more effective. And also, if she's outside working in an outside environment, or if she's working with a lot of men in a macho-type environment, like, for example, in a garage or on a ranch or as an architect or doing an excavation, as an archaeologist, and if she's outdoors and men are just the colleagues and they're all wearing pants, then she could be at a disadvantage, and she would be seen as perhaps, you might say, having less authority than the men if she wore, a skirt in those types of environments. But in general, and most women don't realize this, and they rebel against
it. Yeah, I didn't realize that either. That's new to me.
And then they get annoyed at me, and I have feminists attack me from all over the world for this research. And I'm simply reporting what the research reveals.
Right, exactly. And I mean, that's what this is about. It's like the research says that this doesn't look good. I applaud you. I had no idea. And I always see her in pantsuits, and I always wondered, what is she putting out to people who may want to see her in a dress or may want to see her in a skirt suit? So, I had no idea.
And Juanita, the other thing is that what you're saying is your impression of her. And the other thing is that it's an unconscious thing, and it's not something that people would consciously realize when they go to the voting booth, but it will, I predict, it will hurt her politically.
Oh, wow. So, and now you mentioned something earlier about, you know, if a woman was severely overweight. Speaking of overweight, how effective is that as far as getting promotions? I mean, and I know this is a sticky subject, but, you know, can women who are severely overweight or, you know, big, you know, how, what are their chances of dressing for success?
Well, they can, and in fact, it's more important if you have a body image like that. And 99% of our clients feel that they are that they need to lose weight, and that's why we have a vigorous and aggressive and a controversial weight loss research component to Manhattan Makeovers, where we suggest things that is the opposite of what you will hear from your physician. And but it is very important for people who are very tall, very short, or who are significantly overweight. It's more important for them to dress correctly in order to be successful.
Yeah, and what would you say is like one of the biggest mistakes that men make as far as dressing?
Well, the two mistakes men make are they fail to comb their hair and shine their shoes.
And shine
now,
shoes,
now, today,
yeah.
You're laughing because today, you know, it's a style to be, you know, to have spiky hair or... But those styles are fads, and they are not tested, except we know that if you have spiky hair or messy hair, we actually do know that you will be less successful with men who are over 50, and these are the type of men who are going to either hire you or not hire you and promote you or not promote you, typically.
And do you suggest a man who... is graying prematurely or whatever, or a woman, should they color their hair? I mean, should they, you know, seek the professional of getting their hair color?
Well, I know how annoying it is to have to color your hair once you start.
Oh, and, God, yes.
And, you know, and the other problem is that every single hair dye, or almost everyone, 95% of them, have harmful chemicals in them, which have been associated with cancer and lymphoma, which is a type of cancer. I mean, Jackie Kennedy used to dye her hair black all the time, and she died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which has been linked to hair dye exposure. There's only one brand of hair dye that we have found. It's called Palette by Nature. That is all organic and it's safe. We're not affiliated with them. But yes, we do recommend, especially for women who have graying hair, because if you do have gray hair, it will reduce your effectiveness at work. For men who are just starting to gray, sometimes it actually increases your effectiveness because people think, oh, he's got a lot of experience. But when your hair becomes too gray, or it's salt and pepper, or it's more gray than a dark color, then you will lose effectiveness in many cases, but not all cases. I mean, look at Anderson Cooper. He has totally white hair. He's extremely successful.
Right.
So there are cases where you can get by with silver or gray hair.
Okay, so what is the biggest image mistake that women make?
The number one mistake is that they try to match their shoes' color to their outfit. And our research reveals that your shoes are more effective if they are at least two tones darker than your outfit. And they could be significantly darker. In fact, you could wear black shoes with even a white outfit or a white dress and totally successful.
Really?
Yes.
And pantyhose versus bare legs. Because I know that the first lady, you know, during it, when it gets warm or whatever, she normally does a lot of bare leg. And she wears dresses with bare legs and shoes.
Yes, you can wear with bare legs, but it's often more effective to use some kind of a stocking there. And it should not be any color other than your leg color unless you are very thin. And in that case, you can wear a darker or a black stocking and be effective.
So now all this image talk or whatever, I'm improving my image. I'm taking your advice. You know, you schooled me, whatever. Now, if I do all that, can I actually make more money?
Yes, I believe that there's no question, and in fact, I can tell you without any equivocation that our research reveals that dressing more effectively will increase your income, especially if you're in a field like sales, where we do have the actual proof that you will earn more than your colleagues if you simply make a few changes. But it goes across the realm, or across almost all professions. A person is more likely to be promoted, to be hired, and to do better if they're dressed appropriately.
And all these women or men, you know, and I guess I can throw this out to you too. Should men wear makeup or some type of makeup? And then
no.
The other part
is
should women seek out professionals as far as how to look good, as far as proper hair and makeup? Because I know men wear makeup. Some men do wear makeup.
The problem with a man wearing makeup is the same thing as a man wearing a pink shirt or tie. It is perceived as less effective unless,
okay.
And there are exceptions, he's a stage actor or he's appearing on television or he's, you know, on stage for a rock concert or something of that nature.
What if he's just wearing makeup like just to make himself look like he's more rested, so he wants to look tan, so he's not like doing full-fledged lashes or whatever. He's kind of like, you know, just adding a little tinted moisturizer. Because I know a lot of guys, they'll ask me about tinted moisturizer because they want to look, it makes them appear to look more rested.
Oh, okay. As long as it's not perceivable to people looking at them that they are wearing a colorant or a makeup, then it's a very almost Machiavellian thing to try, and that could work.
Right. Yeah. But as far as women, if you're going out there and if you want to look the part and you want to, you know, improve your image, should they hire a professional to show them, you know, how to properly make themselves, you know, makeup and hair?
Yes. All of our clients, almost all of them, when they come to New York, we bring them to a professional makeup artist who gives them tips and tricks, and it's worth taking the time. It takes about 45 minutes to an hour, and you will learn a lot, and it can be very helpful, and especially because professional women are expected to wear makeup.
Yeah. And what about eyeglasses? I mean, I see a lot of the new, I'll segue to that. Eyeglasses, but the correct or the right eyeglasses. Can that boost your image? And I'm not talking about, because, you know, you're seeing a lot of those humongous glasses now. They're so big, they're bigger than your face.
Well, those are a distraction rather than an aid. But those are people who have a face where they want to add some kind of sometimes it can add a level of intelligence, or it could also add balancing out certain features. Like, for example, if a person has an oval type of a face that is too round, it may be perceived as less effective, and they could wear frames, even if they don't need prescription, that are
right.
Plain, and then they could balance out their features with a squarish or rectangular type of a frame, and vice versa. If a person has a very squarish or rectangular-looking angular face, they can sometimes modify that or tone it down by wearing oval or round frames.
Oh. It's like you don't even know stuff like that until someone tells you that that's the correct way. Because I had no idea. I just thought that if you put some glasses on, if they look cute, they're effective. But, wow.
Well, yes, but no, you're right about that also. I mean, you can sometimes by your own, you know, general sense of what looks good, you can make a determination. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you can also do a balancing, perform that balancing calculation also.
Now, seeking the advice from you, can it be costly?
It is very costly. Our makeovers are generally, most people can't afford them unless they're you know, an attorney or a doctor or a banker or an accountant who's doing well.
But the benefits are that they will, you know, once they seek your advice, they're being a better position where they can command more or get more.
Yes, I'm not afraid or hesitant to mention that it costs for a 3-day makeover, which is our most popular one, it's $1,900.
That's not bad. That's actually good.
And then we have a 1-day makeover. That's $900, and we're with the person the entire day. These fees do not include the hairdresser. The hairdresser that we use is a celebrity stylist, and the woman has the choice whether she wants to go to him. And almost all of our clients decide they wish to go.
Oh wow! And you've given them a new look too. And you've improved.
And you've improved
their whole outlook.
They look 20 years younger when they come out.
Wow. William Kane, president of Manhattan Makeovers, thank you so much for joining us. Can they reach you at manhattanmakeovers.com?
Yes, they can. And Juanita, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
It's such a pleasure talking to you, William. Thank you so much. And coming up next, we have Dave McCready. He's going to give us some information on hypnosis. Stick with us. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Welcome back to the Beauty Files. William Kane from Manhattan Makeovers. It's a wonderful deal, especially if you are going to improve your image to make a better impression or a better reaction to people around you. So I really do appreciate him taking the time with Manhattan Makeovers. We're joined now with David McCready. Is it McCready or McCready?
McCready, Juanita.
Good. Okay, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing it right. David is a life coach. He's an acupressure practitioner, and he's an advanced clinical hypnotherapist. We're talking today with David about hypnosis because this is one of those things that, David, a lot of people, you know, I always send out emails and ask people, you know, different topics that they would love to hear on the show. And one of the top three was hypnosis and how it can affect or make someone either lose weight, create a better self-image. So correct me, or first of all, welcome to the Beauty Files.
Thank you.
tell me about hypnosis.
Hypnosis doesn't make you do anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's what people, that was the question. So, you know, I'm glad you displayed it. Yeah, tell me what hypnosis does.
Hypnosis strengthens the subconscious. If there's something you want to do, if you want to lose weight, but have difficulty yourself getting into that, then hypnosis can strengthen that subconscious mind of yours and help you to accomplish your goal.
Hmm. How?
Well, we talk to the subconscious mind, and we tell it the goals that the client wants to do, and we tell it certain things you can stay away from sweet foods, or you can just take just ingest just a little bit at a time at different parties. Some of us have little tricks that we teach our clients to redirect their thoughts to a more pleasant environment, so that their thoughts on sweetness or food takes a back seat.
So what is the process? I mean, if someone wants to come in and, you know, you're always hearing people talking about hypnosis helps people stop smoking, you lose weight or whatever. What is the process? What do you do? How do you take this person from this point to that point?
Well, what I do is I sit and talk to the client for anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes, try to find out what it is they really want, and find out where their happy place is in their life or their secure places in their life. It can be anywhere to the day they were born and all this. Mm-hmm. And then I have them lay down on a massage table or some other flat surface. Because to me, a person can relax more, you know, on a flat surface than in a chair.
Oh,
although a lot
okay.
of hypnosis therapists use a chair, a recliner. And then I talk them into a relaxation, get them nice and relaxed, and redirect their conscious mind to do a minor task, such as the doctors use when they say count back from 100. And as they're doing that, as the conscious mind is actually doing a task, I continue on with my scripts and boost their subconscious towards the goal that they want. Some of my clients have actually fallen asleep, and I continue with the script and all this because the subconscious is still aware of what's happening even when you're asleep. And when I bring them out with the awakening script, even though they're asleep, they come right back out and awake without my even touching them.
Can everyone be hypnotized? Because, you know, I'm going to throw I've never, you know, no one has ever tried to do it to me or, with, you know, for me. But is everyone a willing participant? I mean, can everyone be hypnotized? Is there, like, some people who just can't be because of, for whatever reason?
Yes, there are people that cannot be hypnotized. Young kids, adults with mental problems in that they can't focus on one thing for a while, and people that are or want to be in control of their lives to the nth degree.
Oh.
You do have
really?
To be open and accept and trust that your hypnotherapist is going to help you. And that takes a lot.
Yeah. I can imagine. You know, but I'm thinking I may be one of those people.
You could be. It's amazing. Some people come in strong, and after I've talked to them for a little while, they tend to relax and accept the hypnosis.
And it's just, and when you do this procedure or this process, are you just talking to them, or you know how we used to see on television, someone would wave a watch and dangle the watch back and forth? I mean, are you just talking to a person and then they fall into a trance?
That's one of my beginning spiels to my clients is a lot of these hypnotists that you see on TV have actually pre-picked their subjects. The clowns that would do anything.
Really?
Now, the watch, if you're talking about the watch itself, it's basically redirecting the conscious mind to do something so they talk to the subconscious.
Okay, so you see they have the watch, they have like a light, like some type of light shining or something. I've seen that. So this is basically
anything
just
to redirect your conscious mind so the conscious
right.
mind does not interfere. If you've ever
okay.
driven your car and have gone 10 or 15 miles and look around and say, well, how did I get here?
Yeah.
You've been under hypnosis. It's called driveway hypnosis. Now,
what?
Yes. And
or if you've driven someplace and you didn't realize, you know, it's like you're an automatic pilot and you just like you wanted to go somewhere else, but you automatically go somewhere else and you don't even realize you did it. Is that the same?
Exactly. Now,
well,
the thing is, under hypnosis is the same thing. You're never in danger because you are aware of what's going on. So even though you were under driving hypnosis, you're still able to make the turns that the road called for.
So I guess I am a candidate because I do that all the time. I you know, and it's funny because, David, I find myself driving someplace, and I want to go somewhere else, and I automatically go to the same place, and I say, wow, how did I get here this fast? Or how did I get over here?
Exactly. Your conscious mind just either took a break or was thinking about something else, and your subconscious mind took over.
And David, you also do life coaching. Tell us about that, because that's something that I would love to know about, too.
Life coaching is very similar to hypnosis, I've found, and sometimes I've even used both intermixed with my clients because it does help out in another aspect, in that I tend to get my clients to understand what it is they want and why they're acting the way they are from within their own thoughts. In other words, someone might be really anxious about doing something in their future, and it's because of something that's happened in the past. And if I can talk to them and get them to understand that, you know, what happened in the past is not relevant today, then their anxiety tends to go away in the present and future.
Oh, okay. And you also do not only just for individuals, but you do couples. Is that a good process to do with couples if they're having problems in their marriage or their relationships? Can, you know, life coaching help for that?
Yes, I think that's a very strong way. Being a life coach, I can't prescribe medicines or anything like that, but I am the intermediary between the two opposing forces.
Oh, okay.
So I can get them to look at themselves and at each other and find out, you know, do we really want to do this, or can we adapt?
Right. And explain to us what Reiki is, because I know a lot of people are really into Reiki. I love Reiki, and I know what Reiki is, but a lot of our audience don't know what Reiki is, and you also do that as well. So you're a jack of all trades. You do everything.
I got into natural therapies back in 95, and I went to many classes, and the ones that I really liked are the ones I went ahead and got certified in. The others, I have enough knowledge to be in trouble.
Oh,
but
wow.
Reiki itself is it's energy manipulation over the client. Some people stay a couple of inches off the client. Some people touch the client. And it depends on both the practitioner and the client as to what's the best way. I find touch is better because they get... They can feel me in the area. Reiki is being able to see or feel where the energy is the lowest at a client. And we can push energy from what we call the universe through us into the client.
Really?
And push out the bad energy.
Really?
Go ahead.
No, I said, I'm just saying, really?
Yes. I've had lots of clients all my clients get up and they really feel good over this. And this was actually one of the hardest ones for me to get into. You didn't tell your audience, but I'm also a computer nerd. I run my own computer.
Yeah, I saw that too. It said traveling tech. That's why I said you are a jack of all trades. So you can come over, fix our computer, and then give us do a Reiki session on us as well. You do it all.
Well, to get into the natural field was really interesting, because as a computer nerd, you've got to see or touch it to believe it. Reiki is not something you can see or touch. It's only feeling. And it took me a little bit longer than most of the students that I was with, but now I am very proficient at it and enjoy it.
So when you say, you know, you're touching and feeling stuff, what do you feel? What are you touching? I mean, what are you trying to feel? Because I'm not understanding that. I mean, I think it's phenomenal that you said, you know, the universe and energy. But what are you feeling? What are you trying to feel? What are you trying to get them to feel?
You can feel the aura around the person.
Really?
Everyone has an aura. Every living thing has an aura. Some are larger than others. The size of the aura doesn't matter. I think you've heard this before.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I can feel the energy around the person. But to me, it's almost a solid cocoon around the person. Some practitioners can feel vibration or heat and cold around the person. Now, when I feel the energy around the person, I can feel the coldness where they are having problems. They can come onto my table, and as I do the scan, which is the first step for Reiki, just mm-hmm. to check the whole body, I can feel coldness and say, well, it's cold over your knees. And 9 times out of 10, they'll tell me they have knee problems.
Oh.
And so I would concentrate more Reiki on the knees. I would still do the whole body, but concentrate more sending energy into the knees to help them out.
And you're touching, are you doing light touching? Are you doing...
light touching, yes.
Okay. So it's not like acupressure, I guess.
No, acupressure and shiatsu are more stimulating with pressure of the thumb or elbows or the forearms.
Oh. And you know, I'm reading something from what you sent me about Reiki. You said after a session, clients typically report that they see their path in life more clearly.
Yeah, they're a lot more relaxed, and they're open to the thoughts of the universe, of what's around them. I'll tell you, that's one application that a lot of us practitioners like, because the energy comes through us and through them, and it makes us feel good, too, because we get the same benefit.
So I'm going to throw something kind of I saw on TV and, you know, I saw in a movie. But what if you encountered someone who had bad energy, like really bad energy, like just demonic energy? Could you feel that?
Can I fix that?
Could you feel it if someone had really bad energy?
It would be still a process. I think we could still help them. It may take more sessions if their bad energy has been stored for a long time. I think you've seen people on TV shows where somebody lays hands on a person and then they take the headache away from the person but have it themselves.
Right.
They are not actually doing Reiki the correct way. they are taking the energy from the client. And what we're doing is passing the energy from the universe through us and through the client. So we don't get that headache, but we pass their headache away out into the universe.
Oh my gosh. This is so interesting.
You know,
this is so interesting.
Taking the classes and all.
Yeah. See, because I would think that this would be good for people who are suffering from mental illness, and that you can kind of, you know, get the energy to go to another place.
Well, I'm not a doctor, so mental illness to me could be physical. And if it is, Reiki's not going to be helpful. Hypnosis won't be helpful. Life coaching won't be helpful if that's what it is.
Oh, okay. David McCready, again, he is a life coach. And I also need to mention this before I let you go, David, that he started a company called Traveling Techs. And I'm thinking the way the name of the business is that you go to different places and you fix a person's computer. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Oh, that's a wonderful gig. So how do you find time for that?
I've been a computer since 65, and when I retired from my real job, I opened my own business to continue.
Okay. And where can we find you, David, if we want to get hypnotherapy or Reiki or life coaching? How can we find you for that?
Well, the webpage is Washington Institute of Natural Medicine.
Yeah, I love the Institute. It's a fabulous place. If anybody has not been there, it is a spectacular place. It's everything. Yeah, you'll love going to the Washington Institute of Natural Medicine.
Thank you, Anita.
In D.C. I love that place. I love everyone that I've had as a guest, and the practitioners are fabulous. And I encourage you guys that, you know, starting before spring, check out David, give him a call, check out the Washington Institute of Natural Medicine.com. And they do have a website. And like I said, they are located in Washington, D.C. So I would encourage you to see what you can gain from hypnotherapy, Reiki, or just getting some life coaching from David. David, you've been a wonderful guest. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Juanita. Thank you.
And coming up next, we're going to be joined by Ruth Greshner. She has come up with a book that's going to teach us people who have no idea about how to make pizza. She's going to teach us how to make pizza at home. So she'll be right with us. Give us about 30 seconds. Welcome back to the Beauty Files. That was David McCready from the Washington Institute of Natural Medicine. Again, they have a wonderful programs there as far as Reiki, hypnotherapy, acupressure, massage therapy. Check them out. They're in Washington, D.C. I believe it's on Wisconsin Avenue, Washington, D.C., and it's the Washington Institute of Natural Medicine, and that was David McCready. We have Ruth Greshner with us. One of my favorite things is pizza. And but, you know, Ruth, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know if I have the patience to throw that dough up and watch it whirl and throw it in the oven.
Well, you don't have to. It's always fun to play with your food, so throwing food up in the air and catching it, you know. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's not imperative that you do that. You can make great pizza stretching the dough right on the countertop.
Oh, my God. So tell us about your book, about the Kitchen Workshop Pizza.
Well, I've been working on this book for a couple of years. I own a pizzeria in Washington, D.C. It's called Pizzeria Paradiso. We were the first Neapolitan-style pizzeria in the Washington area. We've been around for over 20 years. And in the last few years, I decided that I had something to say about pizza, and so I decided to write it down. And what I wanted to say was to give really, really clear, concise instruction to a home cook about how to make pizzeria-style pizza in their house.
I have to segue and just say this real quick. Pizzeria Paradiso, fabulous, fabulous place. I love that place.
Oh, thank you.
I love the pizza. I love the fact that when you eat a pizza, it tastes like a real pizza. It doesn't taste, doughy. It just tastes amazing. So I love your place.
Well, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.
I love your place. But so what do I need to do, or how do I get started making, you know, trying to do my own pizza at home? What do I need? Do I need to get a brick oven?
Well, you could, just like you could throw the dough, you could have a brick oven. But the trick that I use and instruct in my book is how to use your home oven to make the best pizza possible. And the couple of things to keep in mind are the moisture content of your dough and the temperature of your oven. So the way I instruct to maximize your oven is to do the preheating of the oven and the first bit of the cooking of the pizza using the broiler element.
Really?
So that enables, yeah, that enables you to get your oven to a temperature that's higher than its bake setting. And, you know, the other piece, the piece of equipment that helps with that also is a pizza stone. So it's all, it's a good thing if you have a pizza peel that you can build the pizza on. You could build it on the back of a sheet pan, but a pizza peel is also makes the job easier. But other than a pizza stone, possibly a pizza peel and a dough cutter, you know, you don't need anything special in order to do this.
And should you place, you know, because I know there's some, there's a pizza that I buy, I kind of like, it's from my local grocery store, and you, they suggest, or they want you to put the pizza directly on the inside, yeah, without putting it on anything, just stick it in the oven.
I don't recommend that.
Okay.
Unless your dough is pre-cooked to a certain extent, you know.
Yeah,
not,
it is. It's pre-cooked. It's like a frozen pizza. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like a frozen pizza.
Yeah, that could work. I would still recommend using a stone because a stone holds the heat and it will conduct the heat to your crust a little bit better than just the air in the oven. But if you tried to, you know, if you tried to take a raw dough and throw it right on the rack, you'd have a big mess. So we don't want to do that.
and in your book, you have seven variations on the tomato cheese pizza recipes for dough. And you also have a gluten-free pizza dough. You also have your classics, which would the classics be considered pepperoni and sausage?
No, the classics would actually be considered more on the more Italian classics.
Oh,
so, you know, the meat that we would use in the Italian classics section is prosciutto. So the way I set up the book is I start with the simplest sort of iconic pizza, and that would be the tomato and cheese pizza. Mm-hmm. And as you said, there are seven variations on that. So there are seven different doughs. One of them is the dough from Pizzeria Paradiso. One of them is a like certified Neapolitan style dough. One is a whole grain dough. And then, as you said, we had the gluten free. And then from there, it's the Italian classics. So there's the four cheese pizza, which, you know, is also iconic. The margherita pizza is the classic Italian pizza. And then we have a section that's about the pizzas that we serve at Pizzeria Paradiso. And then from there, we branch out into things that you've probably never imagined putting on a pizza. So, you know, there's a section that's on about sauces, and we go from sort of a more common idea for a sauce, which is a roasted red pepper sauce, to something that I imagine is very unusual for people would be a black bean sauce. So we have a whole lot of different things in that section, and then we go from there, we go to different proteins, including fish, including eggs, and then there's vegetables, and then there's fruit. And in the fruit section, we have both savory uses of fruit and a couple of dessert pizzas as well. So I really tried to cover, you know, it's not everything you could think of for pizza, because really you can put anything on pizza, and it's just about how you treat the ingredients. But
yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I was just about to ask you, is there a wrong thing to put on a pizza? Or, you know, is it right or wrong thing to put on a pizza? I mean, I know that, you know, people are now doing the pineapples and ham. Well, you know, that's mm-hmm. them. I mean, is there a wrong thing to put on a pizza?
There certainly isn't anything wrong. You know, that's one of the things. That's one of the reasons that people love pizza so much, is because you can personalize it. You know, it's both a personal... a representation of your tastes, and it's also a communal meal because it's often shared and there's a little discussion about should we have this, should we have that, and I don't want that on mine. So it becomes, you know, a kind of a communal event to have pizza. But the personalizing of it says, I can, if I like this, you know, am I going to like it on bread, which is kind of what pizza is, you know, it's a crust with toppings. You know, if I'm going to like this with bread, I'm going to like it on pizza. But like I said, you have to think about what the ingredient is. You know, does it need to be pre-cooked? Does it need to be finely diced, you know, finely chopped? What's the treatment of the ingredient? And as long as you treat the ingredient appropriately, then, you know, follow your whims.
And you don't have to necessarily, because I think you just mentioned something about black bean sauce, so you don't necessarily have to have tomato sauce, or do you? Do you always have to have tomato sauce for the pizza? Okay.
Absolutely not. And I mean, pizza is a very ancient food, and it's something that, I mean, it wasn't called pizza, but, you know, it's something that you'll find in a large part of the globe is a crust with things on top that's baked. And that's what pizza is. And so the tomato and cheese pizza that we really think of as defining pizza now is really only 150 or so years old.
Okay, Ruth, I'm going to throw this out there to you. Do you think that the thick crust, or, you know, those pizza now that have a thick crust, do you think those are considered like real true pizza? You know, the ones that got the stuffing, the cheese stuff in the crust?
Well,
I don't.
it's not my personal taste for pizza. But you know, I just said you can do anything with pizza.
Yeah, so exactly. You can do anything you want.
You can do whatever you want.
Oh my God! The name of Ruth's book is called Kitchen Workshop Pizza. It's a hands-on cooking lessons for making amazing pizza, now get this, at home. So that we're going to stress that. And before I let you go, Ruth, tell us about Pizzeria Paradiso. I can't say enough about it. I know I went there when I first went there a long time ago, and I thought this was the most amazing pizza I've ever had. But tell our audience about Pizzeria Paradiso as well.
Sure, sure. So we opened, Pizzeria Paradiso opened in 1991, and my background is cooking, and at the time I was cooking in high-end restaurants, and I wanted something that was a little more accessible, a little more playful, and I settled on pizza, and there was nothing in Washington, D.C. at the time that was focused in the way that we did on a Neapolitan-style pizza. Our pizza is, I'm glad that you're suggesting it, but I think it's really, really fine quality pizza. We use really fresh ingredients. Everything's made in-house. And the crust is the most important part. That was what I was going for. And the style of crust that we have is sort of a rustic country bread style of crust. So it's got a nice, you know, hefty kind of corona around the side, so there's a little bit of bread to dip in olive oil and Parmesan cheese after you've eaten your pizza, and we just use really high quality ingredients, cook it in a wood burning oven, and you know, people seem to like it.
I'm a fan.
I'm glad to hear it.
I am a true fan, Ruth, and I hate to let you go, but I guess we ran out of time. Kitchen Workshop Pizza is the name of her book. It's 200 color photos. It's a beautiful cover. If you look at the book now, you have a beautiful picture of a pizza pie, and you can get it where? At Amazon?
Yes, it's online, and in fact, and then, you know, in bookstores. But if you go to our website, there's a link where it can be purchased. And our website is eatyourpizza.com.
That's eatyourpizza.com. Ruth Gressler with Kitchen Workshop Pizza, hands-on cooking lessons on for making amazing pizza at home. Thank you so much, and thank you for listening to our show. And I encourage you to check out her book, check out the website, and the websites of all of our guests. Until we chat again, take care. Bye-bye.